Welcome, friends, and thank you as always to John Lee Hooker and Carlos Santana for reminding us so beautifully that change is coming. This is Economic Update, a program brought to you every week by the Pacifica Network. Our purpose is to analyze major economic events and trends, the forces shaping our jobs, incomes, taxes, debts, what we buy and what we pay for the goods and services we all depend on. I want to welcome especially KPFA listeners in the Bay Area around San Francisco, and to thank KPFA and Mitch Jezerich in particular for being so kind and supportive as to bring this program to you. I am your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my life at several universities. Currently, I am a visiting professor in the Graduate Program for International Affairs of the New School University in New York City. I also write columns of economic analysis for the website truthout.org, a courageous source of independent news, news analysis, and commentary daily. Please keep sending us your questions and comments. We read each one and select the few we can respond to on the air, but we shape our programs in response to your interests. Send your questions and comments to our website democracyatwork.info. Let us know if you would like us to identify you by name. As usual on this program, Economic Update, we will begin with a few shorter items regarding economic events that have been taking place over the last few days. That's what updating means. Today, we are going to deal with major items in the news for days now, it seems even weeks. And it has to do with the exposure of misdeeds by private banks, the biggest, largest private banks here in the United States, but indeed on a global scale. It hasn't been a good several years for those banks. There have been ongoing bank scandals, and indeed, what happened this last week is more scandal information. But to begin, it would be useful if we review the scandals that have beset large, private, profit-driven banking. First, and I'm talking about scandals that they have admitted and or been prosecuted for and or been fined in the millions of dollars for committing. First, money laundering. Several of the biggest banks have admitted and paid fines for having basically assisted criminal activities in laundering their money to enable them to escape detection and to escape punishment. An even bigger scandal had to do with the London Interbank Offer Rate. That's an arrangement located, obviously, in Great Britain, whereby large banks establish a uniform interest rate, which is then used around the world by credit card companies, loan companies. Anyone who charges interest for a loan pretty much makes the decision about what interest rate to charge you or the company you work for or the bank you do business with for the loans they need to operate. They all benchmark, it's called, benchmark their interest rates in relationship to LIBOR, the London Interbank Office Rate. And it turns out that this rate, by influencing the interest rates around the world, is very, very important. And so the largest banks in the world turn out to have been manipulating that rate, systematically over-reporting what they ought to have or under-reporting, manipulating that interest rate because it is based on what the biggest banks report to London in order to make more money and thereby squeezing the millions of us who depend on credit directly or indirectly, putting us in a position where we're paying not what we ought to based on what interest rates really are, but rather what the banks would like to make them be. The third scandal they've been involved in, the big banks, is charging excess fees for credit cards, for, you know, late checks, for insufficient balances, and milking more money out of their customers by doing it. The fourth scandal is that the big banks have marketed mortgage-backed securities, these peculiar kinds of investments in which case you are buying not a share of a company that makes something, but rather a portion of a debt, a portion of a group of mortgages, and your interest in buying that property is because you then get a cut of the mortgage payments made by the people who borrowed that money. And they had apparently, and they've been convicted now of it, many of them, issued these securities backed by very sketchy mortgages that in the end were never paid back by those who borrowed because they weren't doing it. And finally, the banks were caught up in making risky investments with their depositors' money, often feathering their own nest along the way. So you can see that the list of past scandals is enormous, and the money involved is enormous, and the number of people around the world affected by this is likewise enormous. You might have thought that any private industry caught, exposed, convicted, and fined for such a list of staggering misbehavior would have raised serious questions about its rights to continue and would have evoked from the public and from the government radical solutions appropriate to the scale of their misdeeds. But that didn't happen. Indeed, later today we will talk about one of the few radical solutions that have been proposed and what to think about that. But this last week, all of this became more intense. And as often happens, the way it got exposed was often by virtue of a falling out among these bankers. One big case this week saw the Belgian-French bank Dexia, D-E-X-I-A, in a lawsuit against the huge U.S. bank, the biggest bank, J.P. Morgan. And what Dexia is angry about is they bought a lot of the securities, mortgage-backed securities, that had been bundled together and marketed by J.P. Morgan, and they are screaming that they were sold bad securities, securities that J.P. Morgan knowingly sold them and knowingly did not tell them that they were based on mortgages where the prognosis of those ever being paid by the people who had borrowed that money was very poor. I should mention that J.P. Morgan had a subsidiary, Bear Stearns Corporation, which was earlier accused of doing the same thing, marketing bad mortgage-backed securities, and that J.P. Morgan was found as the parent of Bear Stearns to be culpable and has already paid over $296 million in fines. But it turns out that the subsidiary Bear Stearns wasn't the only one doing it, that the parent J.P. Morgan was doing it and is now in court being sued by Dexia for just these activities. Likewise, this last week, we had an even more bizarre case. In this case, one of the biggest banks in Great Britain, the Royal Bank of Scotland, was found to have participated in the manipulations of that LIBOR rate in London. In other words, here's a monstrous bank, one of the biggest in the world, using its money and its power to manipulate the interest rate, the LIBOR rate, out of London, that affects trillions of dollars, with a T, trillions, of loans around the world. It affects how much interest we have to pay. So they're going to have to pay an enormous fine, it turns out. The British and American governments fining the Royal Bank of Scotland for the manipulation of LIBOR. The reported fine, $612 million. So we're talking about a healthy bit of change, to say the least. But I'll come back to what that means a little bit later. But here's what's bizarre about the fine to be paid by the Royal Bank of Scotland. The Royal Bank of Scotland collapsed in the great crisis of 2007 and 2008. And, as happened in so many countries, turned to the British government for a bailout, which they got. So that, as we're speaking now, the bank, which was fined by the British government, turns out to be owned by the British government. 82% of the Royal Bank of Scotland is owned by the British government. So that now, let's see how that works. The British government imposes a fine on a bank that is owned by the British government, so that the British government will have to pay the fine to itself. Oh, goodness. What a strange arrangement. Nothing, in other words, is happening here. This is a bit of a shell game. Yes, they decorate it with taking back some of the big bonuses they gave to some of the top executives at Royal Bank. And yes, some of the money that the British public will have to pay in a fine to the British government will be matched by a fine paid to the American government because it is one of the authorities pursuing this. But when all the dust settles, what can we say about all this strange play? Well, let's begin by a comment from the Attorney General of New York State, Eric Schneiderman. He did a calculation about the total losses from the kinds of activities that J.P. Morgan pursued with its toxic marketing of badly backed mortgage securities. His estimate, just to pick one to give you the orders of magnitude, $22.5 billion with a B. Well, let's see. The kinds of fines that J.P. Morgan has paid, the $296 million through Bear Stearns a while back, and a few hundred million they're going to have to pay for what they've been accused of now and the suits that are being filed against them, they all work out to less than 1 or 2% of the damage they did. Of the monies they made themselves, these are small percentages. And the same is true for the Royal Bank of Scotland. It is a hundreds of billions of dollars worth of business a year, and the total fine they look to have to pay for years worth of manipulating LIBOR is $612 million, not even $1 billion, and they do hundreds of billions a year. So you can see that the conclusions, the meaning of what we're watching, is really this. The level of illegal, unethical, self-serving behavior by private large banks in the world, American, British, and others are involved, is monumental. The social impact on the world through the trillions of dollars of loans and interest rates affected by all of this is monumental. But the fines to those committing these monumental burdens on the society as a whole are tiny. And is the system basically being changed? Not at all. Not at all. Even if we punish a few executives, we are leaving in place a system that makes it profitable for executives to behave this way, which is why they do, that will continue to make it profitable for the next group of executives to behave in the same way, as indeed they have been caught doing for a long time. There really isn't much of a conclusion we can draw, or that anyone serious can draw, other than this. The private banks pursue profits in ways that continuously and in many forms damage the larger society, economically, politically, and socially. But they have enough power to postpone, to delay any punishment, and to make sure that if the punishment finally comes, it'll be small. And finally, to make sure that whatever the punishment is doesn't change the basic system that keeps them on top, keeps them in a position to do these sorts of things, and to make them smile at the public frustration with how this all continues. My second update has to do with a remarkable event this last week that highlights an issue we need to worry about. This has to do with the broadband internet service, upon which we rely in the United States more and more as our basic communications utility. The internet is replacing the TV, it's replacing the telephone. It is the way in which we more and more rely on getting information, passing information, communicating with one another, with our employers, with our entertainment sources, with whatever they are. And here's the irony. A lawyer, a professor of law named Susan Crawford, who teaches at the Cardozo Law School, released a book last week, published by the Yale University Press, with this interesting title, Captive Audience, the Telecom Industry and Monopoly in the New Gilded Age. Basically, what she's saying is that high-speed internet access through wires is now the essential way most Americans communicate. It is not an industry, however, in which there's much competition, and there's not an industry, therefore, here in the United States that delivers to us anything like the possible internet wireless service we could have. Here's what Crawford argued in an interview she gave recently with Time magazine. Quote, American consumers have fewer choices for broadband service at higher prices but lower speeds compared to dozens of other developed countries, including throughout Europe and Asia. She gave a telling example in her Time interview. In Seoul, Korea, when you move into an apartment, she said, you have a choice of three or four providers selling you fiber access for, and get this, $30 a month, and the installation happens in one day. As she points out, that's unthinkable in the United States. And it is ironic that the country that invented the internet can't get online. That is, she writes, beyond her imagination. She particularly targets the Comcast Corporation and points out that it and other corporations have made sure to limit and control wired internet access. They make a fortune by the high prices and monthly rates we pay for phone and internet access, far higher than is paid in other countries for far lower speeds. Private enterprises are in the business of making money, and they do that. Sometimes how they proceed provides useful, cutting-edge service for the markets they serve. And sometimes they make money by systematically underserving and overcharging. According to Professor Crawford, broadband wired internet access is an example of the latter. And we should think about what it means to leave something so fundamental as internet access when we now rely on the internet in the hands of institutions, private profit-seeking corporations that abuse the public trust, rather like those banks we discussed at the beginning of the program, abuse our dependence on finance. Serious problem, one that deserves attention. Our last brief update for today, before we turn to our more substantive discussions of major issues, has to do with this release on Thursday of last week by the John J. Heldrich Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers University, which is the state university in New Jersey. It reports, this survey does, a very interesting statistic that's worth our noticing. While only 8% of Americans are listed as unemployed right now, for example, in the United States, and that's been true for most of the last year, that doesn't measure the total number of people that are affected by unemployment, right? The same people are not in that 8%. So they'd first discovered that nearly a quarter of Americans, 25%, say that they were laid off at some point during the recession or afterward. Whoa. Over the last 5 years, then, 25% of Americans have experienced unemployment. They went further. And they asked unemployed people, and then they asked the population in general, how many of you know someone, either among your family members or your close friends, who has been or experienced unemployment over the last few years? And the answer they got may surprise you. 8 in 10 Americans say, in a systematic survey conducted by the State University of New Jersey all across America, that they know someone in their circle of family and friends who's been unemployed. Why is this important? Because knowing about unemployment is as profound an impact on you, knowing that someone in your family, someone in your close circle of friends is unemployed, is almost as profound an experience as being unemployed yourself. You feel their pain. You hear and see their suffering. They may lean on you for advice, for help, for emotional support, for a loan of some money. You are affected. Here's the proof of the effect. A majority of Americans now say, in the same poll by the same university, that they think it will be at least 6 years before the economy is made whole again, if it ever is. 3 in 10, 30%, said that the economy would never fully recover from the current recession. If a majority of Americans, or even small minorities, sizable minorities such as this, believe that, they will curtail their expenditures. They won't buy as many goods and services because they understand they're in hard times that are likely to last, and that makes the recession worse. In other words, unemployment builds on itself. It is a crisis that we are in, and it is extending itself. Something long ago should have been done. And that's something we will return to many times. So much for our short updates. We turn now to the larger topics that will occupy us over the next middle section of this program. One of the ideas of analyzing something important that came to me in preparing today's program was to follow up our update about banks by talking a little bit about a solution that is gaining a certain amount of traction in the United States and in other parts of the world as well, in the wake of what? Of all those banking scandals we talked about earlier. In the wake of the upset that big banks are not lending money to many, many businesses that are in trouble because of it, let alone to consumers. And finally, in the wake of that too big to fail scandal, in which the big banks claimed they had to be bailed out by the government at enormous public expense because it was too dangerous to let them fail because they take down the whole economy with them. In response to that, some people have begun talking about breaking the banks up, not allowing there to be big banks, making banking once again something done by much smaller, much more competitive banks rather than the huge monsters like Bank of America or J.P. Morgan, Wells Fargo, and the other familiar names. Last month, the traction got even bigger as a very important person spoke out in a surprising intensity about this problem. I'm speaking of the person, Richard W. Fisher, who is president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, Texas. That's an important official, sits on the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System that basically controls the money supply here in the United States. He wants, he said in a speech on January 16th, to break up the big banks, to, quote, no longer threaten taxpayers with bailouts, and to lend more. Wow, he was really doing it. Small businesses, including banks, must submit to the rigor of the free market. And he doesn't like that mega banks throw their weight around. They have too many shareholders to police the risk and to enable them, because they're so big, they can elude regulators. And he points out a statistic well known to watchers of banks. First, that there are 5,600 commercial banks in the United States, and that 5,500 of them, namely 98.6 of the banks, altogether control 12% of bank assets. Wow. 70% of bank assets are owned by the 12 largest banks. In other words, the big banks are monsters and completely dominate the field. So what about this idea of solving the bank problem by making them smaller? Here's the problem with that solution. Small banks, as anyone who studies banking knows, have always been very powerful players in their local communities. You don't get rid of monopoly by making smaller banks. You just make the monopolies smaller and more local. Number two, it is capitalism's mechanism to go from small enterprise to big. The competition among small competitors has winners and losers. The losers go out of business and sell their assets and move their workers to the winners. Monopoly is the result of competition. And if you break a monopoly back into competition, you simply set the stage for the same game to be played out again. We had many smaller banks in the 1930s, and we had a worse depression than we have with the big ones now. In other words, breaking banks into smaller units isn't a real and a serious solution. Here's one that is. We ought to change banking. It ought to be controlled by the people from the top by making banks a national service we provide people. It's too important to be left in the hands of private bankers. They have driven us to distraction and abused us in more ways than you can count. But it shouldn't just be control from the top. There should also be matching control from the bottom. And the way to do that is to make banks organized as cooperatives in which all the workers, the tellers, the loan officers, the credit managers, all of them, are part of a community that includes the depositors, those who depend on the bank, who can collectively make the decisions about the enterprise, even as a community from above, they monitor and control them. The cooperativization and the socialization of banking is a way, finally, to make it serve our interests rather than constantly abuse us, requiring us to search and hunt and follow them, periodically break them up, only to see the same game played again. Before we turn to our next substantive conversation, we will have our usual mid-program musical break. Please stay with us, and we will resume in about a minute.
Broken trees, broken treaties, broken vows, broken hands, unbroken plows. Ain't no use running, honey, ain't no use joking, nothing's working, everything broken. Broken life, hanging by a thread, broken bones, in a broken bed, broken mirror, broken chair, broken road, going nowhere, broken words, never meant to be spoken, can't help it, honey, everything broken.
Welcome back to Economic Update. This is Richard Wolff, your host. And we're in that part of the program where we take an important story from the last few days and give it the kind of analysis you won't probably see in the mainstream media. And indeed, you may not see anything about these stories if they fall below the radar of what those media think is worth reporting about. This segment might be entitled, to give it a little bit of drama, Capitalism and Tomatoes, because it's about the trade in tomatoes. And this is something that is important, not only because tomatoes figure in a big way in our national diet. Remember the sauce on the pizza, the salad that contains a tomato, the sandwich that has a slice of tomato, and all the other ways that that particular vegetable, some people say it's a fruit, enters into our diet. Well, let's talk about tomatoes. Tomatoes are an agricultural product. They grow in the ground, and they need people to plant them, to fertilize them, to water them, to watch them, to take care of them, to weed the ground around them, and then finally to pick them and pack them and ship them. A lot of work to grow the tomato and bring it to you. What is the truth about agricultural labor? About the market in tomatoes, who produces it, what's going on there? Well, we might start by making a comment about an advertisement that some of you probably saw during the Super Bowl game last weekend. Ah, there was an ad in which you saw farm workers. It was really charming. They were working and getting up and doing the work that brings. It was all charming. It was an ad. It was an ad about something else, but it celebrated the farmer. But it had an image of the farmer as a reasonably well cared for worker, which he and she are not. It had the image of a farm worker as a kind of self-employed person, you might think, sort of upstanding, in charge of his or her own work, hard as it was. And that's not true either, since most farm workers are workers. They don't own their own farms anymore. The self-run, self-owned farmer-worker kind of person is a vanishing phenomena of American society and has been that way for a long time. And it was also interesting that the image portrayed, there were 21 images exactly, counting if in that ad, if you looked at them, 21 images of people representing farmers. 19 of those images were white, one was African-American, one was Latino, but the actuality, the truth about the 3 million agricultural workers in the United States is most of them are not white. Most of them are African-American and even more Latino. And their working conditions are awful, systematically awful here in the United States, and similarly awful in many other countries. For example, and this is where tomatoes come up again, in the country of Mexico. Why is that important? Because tomatoes are an important crop, particularly these days, in Florida and in Mexico. And there has been a fight for at least the last 20 years between tomato producers in Florida and tomato producers in Mexico. And last week, that fight reached a new stage when a special agreement was reached between the United States government and the Mexican government, bargaining on behalf of the Florida tomato growers on the one hand and the Mexican tomato growers on the other. What was the issue? What was the resolution? And what does it mean for us? And what does it tell you about capitalism? That's our topic. First, what was the issue? Florida tomatoes, whose conditions of production are truly awful, and if you are interested, you should take a look at the Immokalee group. The Immokalee is a town in Florida. It has a strong relationship to the tomato business. A lot of tomatoes are grown and grow from there. And the workers there have long ago suffered unbelievable conditions. You can find out all about them because they were organized. They became organized, unlike so many agricultural workers. They organized something called the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, CIW. You can find them on the internet. You can find out lots of information about their conditions. They produce tomatoes, the kinds of tomatoes that end up in what you buy from Taco Bell, Pizza Hut, KFC, McDonald's, Burger King. You know the drill. You know where they all come from. So the conditions are awful. The workers are not paid well. They are not treated properly. They suffer serious health problems from the pesticides and herbicides that are used in the tomato business, and on and on and on. But that's not what our topic is. What was the agreement between Mexico and the United States? Here's what it was. Mexico's tomatoes shipped to the United States are much cheaper than Florida's. And Americans were moving over the last 20 years more and more to the Mexican tomatoes, which turn out not only to be cheaper to produce and therefore can be sold at a lower price, but they are allowed to ripen on the vine. Tomatoes from Florida tend to be picked green and then subject to gas, which changes their color. That might help you understand why fruit and vegetables like those, treated in that way, can end up looking like what you think a tomato is, but tasting like nothing at all. But in any case, the Mexican tomatoes seemed to be riper, seemed to taste better, and were cheaper. And that was hurting the tomato producers. Part of the reason why they were treating their workers the way they did. And the Florida producers were angry. They pressured the government of the United States. Because Florida is a swing state in our presidential elections, their upset got a lot of attention, because if they were angry, they might shift the results in Florida. So they got the ear of the Obama administration, as they had of other administrations before. And lo and behold, we had another deal. What's the new deal? Florida shippers agree to raise their price so that they are less of a competitive danger to the Florida producers. The Mexicans will raise their price so they don't threaten the Florida producer. That's what the Florida producers wanted. That's what the Mexican producers accepted, because they were afraid if they didn't, there would be a trade war between the Mexicans and the United States, and that would hurt them even more. So they took the easier way out, agreed to jack up their prices. Therefore, let everyone who's listening understand, the prices of tomatoes, first and foremost those that come from Mexico, the ones that look and taste a bit better, will be going up in price. That will hurt our pocketbooks. But it will help the growers of tomato in Florida. Will they pass on their good fortune to their workers? Not if past history is any guide. They will enjoy their good fortune by making more money. What's the lesson here? These are capitalist enterprises. Those in Florida are capitalist enterprises, shareholders, boards of directors, employers on the one hand, and workers on the other. And they are capitalist employers in Mexico. They just worked out a compromise that will allow both of them to make a good bit more money, assuming that Americans are willing to pay the higher price for tomatoes that they just worked out with the help of their governments. Is this the story of capitalism that its supporters like to tell? Robust competition among producers, delivering better quality at lower prices to all of us? No, friends. This is real capitalism, in which the capitalists try to use the government to gain an advantage. Not only over one another as best they can, but over the public as best they can, too. And the result? More of those tomatoes from Florida than we might otherwise buy. Higher prices for all tomatoes than we would otherwise pay. More profits for those in the business of doing it. That's how this system works, and that's why it's important to debate and discuss it. Because even the lowly tomato tells the story. Finally, on a major topic that so many of you have asked us about, yet again, in a summary way, a comment. Austerity. This policy pursued in governments from England to Spain to Italy to Greece to the United States and beyond is what? It's a program of cutting government spending and raising taxes. That's what it is wherever it is pursued. In most countries, it's called austerity, but it has other names, too. Names like fiscal responsibility or lowering the deficit. It doesn't take an advanced degree in economics to understand that if you're already in an economic crisis with unemployment, with troubles coming down the road, with cutbacks of government service, that if you pursue an austerity policy, you're going to make matters worse. Because if the government spends less money, that's less goods and services being purchased by the government, fewer jobs to produce those goods and services. And if you raise taxes on people, they have less money to buy goods and services, and so they will generate fewer jobs. So you're not helping the situation, you're making it worse. And why? Because the government has deep debts. Well, friends, the government has deep debts is what they say. But how in the world would it make the situation better when the government has deep debts to raise taxes and lower government spending? Because even if the government can lower its debts, it's at the price of a longer, worse downturn. Is there something else going on? And the answer is yes. and it's important to stress what the purpose of austerity really is. Number one, it's to save corporations and the rich from the tax bill to clean up the crisis they helped to produce and the bailouts that mostly went to them. They don't want to pay for that. And they're upset that they might be asked to. That we might raise taxes here in the United States, for example, back up to what they were in the 50s and 60s on corporations and the rich, much higher than they are today. And that we might use those taxes to pay for the bailouts they got, to offset the crisis they brought, and to thereby lower the deficit because the government wouldn't have to borrow if it taxed corporations and the rich. They don't want to go there. They would rather us have an austerity policy as the necessary way to deal with the deficit. The real issue, they don't want to pay their share of the costs of the mess they made. And the other reason? Private capitalists are always afraid of the government. That's why they denounce it all the time. They're afraid of the government for a simple reason. Governments, at least where there's universal suffrage, are dependent on votes. And the mass of the people have the majority of the votes. That always raises the possibility that the voting could, if organized someday, see the mass of people using the political system to limit, control, and offset the results of the economic system. Precisely, for example, by taxing corporations and the rich to make them pay for the social problems they have created and from which they often profit. They don't want a strong government because they don't want that government ever to take those kinds of steps. So if the people actually captured their government and turned it in that direction, they want that government to be smaller than it is, weaker than it is, in debt, in fact, the way it is. And an austerity program shrinks the government's footprint, makes it weaker and smaller. And that's a bit of safety for the private sector. Those are the objectives of austerity. That's why they pursue it, even though it makes the crisis worse and last longer. Because a deeper crisis that lasts longer for the corporations and the rich is a relatively small price to pay to make sure they're not taxed to pay for the mess they created, and to make sure they're not endangered by a powerful government that might one day be taken over by the people it's supposed to serve. That's the core of what's at stake in austerity politics. We turn now to the final segment of Economic Update. And what we've been doing recently, and what we're going to continue to do, is not only respond to questions and comments that you send in, but in particular, which is itself a response, talk about some of the enterprises that have change the way they do business in the United States and in other countries as well. We've been talking about the Mondragon Cooperative Corporation in Spain a bit in this program over the last year, the example of a very large company that organizes everything where the workers make the decisions democratically about what happens in their enterprise, where there are no shareholders in this case, and where all the decisions are made democratically, and the managers are hired by the workers rather than reverse. And we've talked about smaller ones, and I want to keep telling you a little bit about them. You can find out much more about them and many more examples of them, again, by going to democracyatwork.info, where that information is gathered for you. But I want to give you little stories about them so you get a feeling for them. Today's is an example of a remarkable group of people. They're called the Union Cab Company, or the Union Cab Co-op. It's a workers' cooperative that is a cab company. That's right, taxi cabs. They're located in Madison, Wisconsin, and here's what they now do. First, they do an annual business in excess of $7 million. They have approximately 230 active or probationary members, and they operate 65 taxi cabs. So they're a significant business. They've been around since 1980, so they have a track record. They've survived as a business. In fact, they've survived as a cab business better than cab companies that were capitalist from before. Indeed, it was the history of capitalist cab companies and their failure in the decades before 1980 that created the demand, the space, and the opportunity for a workers' cooperative to come in and do the job better, deliver better taxi service, provide better lives for the taxi workers, and to create a form of business that is a much more satisfying and productive kind of job life for the people involved, but also creates a better rapport, a better feeling between the workers and the community that they serve. Very interesting. The previous cab companies didn't succeed. Often they profited by treating their workers very badly. That provoked a series of strikes and struggles in the 1970s particularly. None of those enterprises could survive. They said that they would have to shut down and there'd be no cab service anymore because they weren't satisfied that it was profitable enough. And the workers, who of course wanted to hold on to their jobs, came along and said, okay, if it isn't profitable, it's still needed. If it isn't profitable, it's still our job. And if it isn't profitable, it doesn't mean that it has to close down. It's possible to organize a business in a different, non-capitalist way, as a cooperative, an institution that says democracy is not only an important value where we live, in our communities, and in governing our political life. It's also an important value in our economic life, on the job, at the workplace. And we're going to show that not only can we create a democratic workplace, not only will that be a much better place for us to work, but we can deliver the goods, quality service needed in a community, benefiting a community, while allowing us to hold our heads high as workers who earn a good living and who run their own business. The Union Cab Company of Madison, Wisconsin, is an example of workers' self-directed enterprises succeeding well and succeeding for the long haul. Again, go to our website, democracyatwork.info, for much more information about the Union Cab Co-op and many other enterprises like it. Now to respond to some of your questions. The first one is simple. Could you explain how an ESOP, often referred to as an ESOP, is alike or different from a WSDE or a worker self-directed enterprise? Well, let's explain what these two things are, because they are indeed similar in some ways and different in others. WSDE, you know from this program and in the past, workers self-directed enterprise. Simply a workers' co-op where the workers themselves collectively operate as their own boss, operate as their own board of directors. That is, the workers do their particular tasks, as all workers do in enterprises, but the difference is they're also their own boss. They also get together, and in a democratic way, one worker, one vote, they decide what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and most importantly, what to do with the profits that all of their labor generates. They don't allow those decisions to be made by a tiny minority, a typical capitalist board of directors of 15 to 20 people, selected by the major shareholders, another small group of people, making the decisions they have to live with. So much for what an WSDE is. What about an ESOP? Well, that stands for Employee Stock Ownership Program, or Employee Stock Ownership Plan. This is a way of describing an enterprise in which the workers own the shares, either individually or through an institution that they support. But the idea is that the owners are also the workers. That's an interesting idea, and indeed, in many workers' co-ops, the workers are also owners. But there is an important difference. To own a company, to own shares in it, does not mean that you run it. It does not mean that you make the decisions what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits. Those decisions are made by the major shareholders, which are typically a small group of wealthy institutions or individuals, and by the board of directors that they select. So here's the problem. If workers own the shares, they may still decide to put the basic decisions of the company into the hands of a board of directors, another group of 15 to 20 people. And the reason we know that's possible is that in many, many cases, employee stock ownership plans, ESOPs, work that way. And guess what? They select the same sorts of people to be on the boards of directors that capitalists typically do. They believe that the board of director type person in a capitalist enterprise is the right kind of person with the right kind of background and the right kind of credentials to run their business that they own as workers. The end result is a corporation that in many ways repeats, reproduces the capitalist enterprise because it continues to be operated that way, allowing a board of directors, a separate group of people, to make the kinds of decisions and to run the kind of company that they used to do in the jobs they typically held before, which was in your average capitalist corporation. In other words, you might think of it this way. An employee stock ownership program is a sign that workers found it appropriate, desirable, or necessary to go beyond being a worker to also become an owner of the company. It's often done to keep the company from disappearing. So it's a recognition of the limits and failures of a capitalist enterprise, and it's a step in the direction of a collective or community operation of production, because the workers become owners in addition to workers. But here's a key difference. Workers need to take the next step also. That's what WSDEs are about. Workers have to become their own directors. That's to make sure that everything that company does, what it chooses to produce, what technologies and ways of producing it chooses to expose its members to, where the production happens, and what is done with the profits, it's important to make sure those are done for the interests of all the workers there in conjunction with the community, not to create a separation between those who do the work and those who make the decisions. So you might think of an ESOP as a step on a trail, on a path that needs to go a good bit further to reach the level of real democracy on the workplace, when the direction of the enterprise, what the board of directors and top executives do, is in the hands of the workers, directly, continuously accountable, not to allow the gap that has been so destructive in the history of capitalism. Let me turn, finally, to an interesting question that was also asked of me recently by one of you. And this has to do again with these worker self-directed enterprises, this alternative to capitalism that is capturing more and more attention around the world. And the questioner asks, how might WSDEs get formed with money? Where would they get the money? How might they raise capital? Especially in a world like today, when they are still a relatively small part of the economy and the dominant model of business is capitalist. How might this work? Where would the money come from? Well, the answer to this is interesting, and I think helps us understand where this interest is coming from and where it's going. First of all, in many cases, workers themselves come up with the money from their own savings, from their friends, from their families, because they can see that the investment in a company like that of your own money is in the end a better thing to do than to invest in some anonymous shares of stock in an anonymous corporation, treating its workers in God knows what way, perhaps working deals with banks and others to mislead you about the safety and the future of your investment. No, it might be better to invest your money in a company where you yourself will be working, and even more important, where you yourself will be the management. You will be the directors. You will have a much better understanding, much better knowledge, much greater transparency, and much greater control over your investment than you would ever get if you invested in another company and turned it all over to people with different identities from your own, different interests from your own, etc. The same is true about going to community institutions and asking them to provide you with money. Local churches, local trade unions, local people's associations of all kinds, maybe even local credit unions, which are themselves a step away from capitalist banking towards a more collective community approach. All of these are sources of money that might begin to be persuaded that investing in collective, cooperative, worker-run, owned institutions is keeping the money local, keeping the money in the hands of the community, not risking it with capitalist enterprises whose crises and whose profit-driven decisions are increasingly at variance with what we all need. I'll return to this question of where SDEs might acquire capital in our next program. This is all the time we have. Thank you again for being with me during Economic Update, and I look forward to talking with you again and bringing you an update on the economy next week.
It won't be long, things ain't gonna change. Sometime in the middle of the night, I get so lonely, so lonely, so lonely. This ain't gonna change, this ain't gonna change. Change, change, change. This ain't gonna change. Put on up the road, baby.